Good morning. My name is Stephen, and I'm one of the pastors here at High Rock. So when I was a kid, every summer, my parents and my sister and I, we would hop into our blue two-door 1981 Corolla, and we would drive 785 miles from our home on the north side of Chicago all the way to my grandparents in New Jersey, in central New Jersey, Somerville, New Jersey. And the car would go like a maximum of 55 miles per hour, and there was no air conditioning in the car, so the windows were open most of the time, right? And the seats were vinyl. Do you guys remember vinyl seats? Some of you maybe do. You don't see that too much anymore. Now here's the issue with vinyl seats. They're freezing in the winter. In the summer, they're super hot, and of course, with no air conditioner, they stay hot. And if you're very hot, you're wearing shorts, and so you sit down on your vinyl seat, and when your skin touches those vinyl seats, it like merges. The two become one. And then as you kind of shift so that your skin can breathe, you're like, you know, like peeling your skin off, and then you get up, like say, you know, you're on a long road trip and you step out of the car and there's like a temporary tattoo of whatever the pattern was on that vinyl or the seams on that vinyl is there on, right there on your skin. This is what journeys were like. Now to make matters worse, my sister, typically on a long car ride, at least once, maybe twice, she would get sick, all right? But it would come with no warning. If there was a warning, okay, fine, you pull over the side of the road, take care of that business, and you move on. But more than often, the situation was that we did not get fair warning, and I'll spare you the gory details. Now, I had my moments too. At least one occasion, I think more, I fell asleep with gum in my mouth. Some of you know where this is going. I woke up with gum in my hair. Oh my gosh. It didn't take my parents long to make the no gum in the car rule after those. Now, 785 miles from Chicago to New Jersey was too much for the Sharkey family to do in one day. So we would stay in a smelly motel called the Knights Inn, halfway between Chicago and New Jersey. And the next morning, we would climb back into that little car, and we literally had to climb in because there were only two doors, so we'd climb in the back. And after having a terrible night's sleep, we would just do it all over again. And of course, the whole way we're just reciting the refrain that you say on road trips. You know what it is? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? No. Are we there yet? No. Are we there yet? No. That gets old after 16 hours in the car. For the parents, of course. It sounds incredible, doesn't it? Right? Road trips are amazing. Well, I should tell you, it was incredible. We actually loved it. Now, why do you think we loved it so much? You don't have to answer that. I'll just dive right in. We loved it so much because we knew what was at the end. A week with Granny and Granddad in New Jersey. We loved them so much that we looked forward to hopping into that little blue car once a year and driving a quarter of the way across the continent to see them. The destination made all the difference. The loving arms of beloved grandparents, a week full of getting spoiled day after day. But what if at the end of a hard journey was something even harder than the journey itself? Right? You might not make that trip, right? So we're about to take a road trip, all right, through part of the book of Luke. And beginning in Luke chapter 9, there's a section of scripture that scholars call Luke's travel narrative. It's a very large section of Luke, about 10 chapters in total, where Jesus is going on a journey toward Jerusalem. And ultimately toward the cross. So that's where we're going in this sermon series over the next 6 weeks. This Sunday is the first Sunday in the Christian season of Lent. These are the 40 days minus Sundays before Easter. Now, these are the days that we journey with Jesus to Jerusalem. This is part of our rhythm as believers during the year. And as best we can, we want to get into the heads of the disciples and those that Jesus is encountering on the road. And we want to understand Jesus, what's going on in his mind and his perspective of this journey that he was going to take. And so we're going to hear his teaching. We're going to hear, we're going to meet some of his disciples, you'll see today, and others who sought him along the way and challenged him along the way. We're going to see some of his miracles. And as we go, we're going to ask ourselves these two important questions. One, who is this guy? Who is this man? It's such an important question because the way we respond to Jesus depends on our answer to that question. And the second question follows that one, is, will I follow Jesus? Will I follow him? Am I willing to go with him on this journey that he's asking us to follow him on? And the fundamental thing that I ask from all the people who come through the doors at our church is that they be curious. Are you curious about Jesus? If you are, if the answer is yes, great, you are in the right place. Jesus can do a lot with that curiosity, and we'll see that towards the end of this journey with a man named Zacchaeus that Jesus meets. So if you're curious, that's great, but ultimately, Jesus asks a lot more than just our curiosity, doesn't he? And we'll see what that looks like today. So are we ready to grab our favorite snacks and go on a road trip with Jesus? All right. Sorry, snacks are going to have to wait until after the service, but we'll dive in there a moment. It's only about 80 miles, all right, 80-mile walk from Galilee to Jerusalem, maybe 4 days. It'll take us probably 5 days with stops for teaching and healing along the way, which incidentally is the number of Sundays that we have between now and Palm Sunday, which is April 10th. That's when Jesus arrives in Jerusalem. So are we ready to begin? All right, Luke chapter 9, and we're going to start at verse 28. So if you have your pew Bibles, that's going to be at page 733 in the Bibles that are there in front of you. If you have your own Bible, Luke chapter 9, and in a few moments, we're not going to get there just yet, but in a few moments, we're going to start at verse 28. But before we dive into the text for today, remember those two questions that I had for us. One, who is this man? Who is Jesus? And will I follow him? The first question, who is this man, is a very important question, and it happens to be the question of Luke up until this point in the gospel. From Jesus' conception to his birth to his boyhood journey to the temple to the beginning of Jesus' ministry in Nazareth, or think about Jesus calming the storm when he's out with his disciples on the sea. All of these instances in Luke keep asking the same question. Who is this man? Who is he? It's a very important question to Luke, and a very important question that we answer. Even John the Baptist, the one who's kind of supposed to prepare the way for Jesus, even he has the same question of Jesus. You know, he baptized Jesus. He knows, like, this is the anointed one. He's going to, but he's wrestling with this. Who is he really? Because I'm not quite sure. I thought that it was going to look like this, and it doesn't quite look like what I thought it was going to look like. So he wants to find out too. And so he sends his disciples to Jesus, and they ask him, are you the one that we've been waiting for? Who is this man? Who is this man? Now, in chapter 9, things start to come into sharper focus very quickly. About Jesus, in regards to Jesus' identity. Now it's Jesus who asks the question of his disciples, who do you say I am? Who do you say I am? To which Peter confidently says, you're God's Messiah. You are God's Messiah. And I think it's worth clarifying before we dive into the text that Jesus does not deny any of this. Okay. Jesus is claiming himself to be the Messiah over and over. Again, Jesus puts himself on level as God himself, which begs another question. What do we do with that? If we're asking the question, who is this man, and he says that he's God, we have to wrestle with that. Because if somebody says they're God, we're limited to a very short list of options. And I've mentioned this several times at our church, and part of the reason I mention this so many times is because this is an important way for all of us to grapple with this question, who is Jesus, and also to engage with the people who are around us. Because everybody in the world has to confront this question, who is Jesus? And the short list of options is great. It's helpful because they all begin with the letter L, so it's super easy to remember. So if Jesus says that he's God, he's either, one, he's lying. So maybe he's a liar, and lots of people have said just that, okay? Or what a lot of people think is maybe he's nuts. Maybe he's a lunatic. Right? Because if you are not God, but you say that you're God and believe that you're God, questionable at best, right? Okay? So he's either lying or he's a lunatic. Now, some have added and suggest that Jesus is just a legend, which is probably the hardest one to defend given the mounds of historical evidence that show us that Jesus walked around this earth, that he said the things that people said that he said. In fact, we have way more evidence that Jesus was walking around than many of the people that we hold up as historic figures that we teach in our history books. Right. Now, if he's not lying, and he's not lunatic, and he's not a legend, then he must be Lord. He must be who he says he is. So you don't have many choices here. But what we can't do is say what most people say about Jesus or want to say about Jesus is that, oh, he was just a good man. He was just a good teacher. Because a good man or a good teacher would not lie, and a good man or a good teacher would not be crazy. All right? He can't be that. So, Peter says, you are God's Messiah, and Jesus doesn't deny it. By the way, that word Messiah, or the Greek word Luke, which is actually the Greek word that Luke uses is the word Christos or Christ. That's a loaded word, okay? It means Savior. It also means King, anointed one. Jesus is in that line of David. He's an anointed king. It means Redeemer. It means all this stuff that's packed with a meaning that's way too overwhelming for the disciples to grasp. And that's going to be one of the themes that we see going on today. This is a lot for the disciples to handle. So good on you, Peter. You got the answer right. But they still don't quite get it. And we'll see some of that. And when Jesus goes on to say in the very next breath, what he says after Peter declares that he is the Messiah, what he says in the next breath is like way over their heads. About once a week, Kathleen and I, we pick up donuts from Dunkin' Donuts for the kids and ourselves. And my youngest son, Aiden, and I, we share a love for the double chocolate donut. Right? And last week, Kathleen came home with a double chocolate donut, and she said to Aiden, guess what, Aiden? You got the last one. And, I think he gleefully took it, grateful that he had gotten the last double chocolate donut. Well, yesterday, as is often the case on a Saturday morning, I offered to go pick up donuts for the boys. And when I asked Aiden what he wanted, he said, double chocolate. And then he paused for a moment, and he said, oh, wait, I had the last one already. He was so confused. I was so confused. The last one? You got the last one? And things start to click for me. And I asked him, I said, Aiden, did Mama tell you that you got the last double chocolate donut the last time you had donuts? He said, yeah, I got the last one. He he doesn't understand that they make new donuts every day. And I explained that to him, and boy, was he excited about that. But this is what it was like for the disciples when Jesus is talking about death and resurrection. Way over their heads. They think they understand, but they do not understand. And in the verses to come, what we're going to see is that some of that confusion finds its way into the disciples' understanding of what's happening with Jesus in this chapter. But Luke is giving us clues as his readers all along the way about what's happening. So we have a better vantage point than the disciples. We get to read through Luke and pick up on these clues and say, oh, this is who Jesus is. Oh, this is what Jesus is about. This is who he says he is. So we see, we have like this, you know, this big view that the disciples didn't have. So ready to dive in? I'm sorry, that was a long intro. Okay. And this morning's going to be kind of expository, so we're going to do a lot of just kind of going through verses. And we're going to land at this moment that's perhaps one of the most mysterious moments in all of the Gospels. It's called the Transfiguration. And the timing is remarkable. Luke has established, okay, Jesus is God. Or at the very least, Jesus thinks he's God, or is trying to convince everybody else he's God. But that is the statement that Jesus is saying and that he has told the disciples, and now the disciples believe Jesus is God. All right? Then he describes, Luke describes, this mysterious moment that we call the Transfiguration. It's called the Transfiguration because Jesus' appearance changed from his earthly, fleshly appearance to his heavenly, glorious appearance. So he's glowing. He's full of light and glory. And I apologize in advance because, yes, I did just say we're going to kind of do a bit of verse by verse this morning, but we're not going to do too much of that with the Transfiguration, I know some people read through this text and they're like, what is going on here? This is strange. I don't get it. So we're just going to pull a couple of critical points out of this particular part this morning. Okay, so the reading, Luke chapter 9, and we're going to begin at verse 28, and we'll take this through 36 for now. This is the Transfiguration of Jesus. About 8 days after Jesus said this, that is after he told them he was going to die and rise again, he took Peter and John and James with him and went up on the mountain to pray. Now remember these three disciples. Luke will illustrate for us in the text that follows how badly these three disciples are missing the purpose of Jesus, even though no one was closer to Jesus than these three men. So, as Jesus was praying, the appearance of his face and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving, Peter said to him, Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He did not know what he was saying. And I'm just going to pause for a minute and say, I love that Luke pauses here to comment on how badly things are flying over their heads. All right? They do not get it. So if you thought you were confused about this mysterious event, that Jesus starts to glow and has a meeting with a couple of famous oldies, don't worry. You are in very, very good company. Three of arguably the most important disciples were completely confused, and they were right there. Okay? So Peter wants to build tents or something, and James and John they're in La La Land. We'll get to their level of confusion in a few minutes. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared to covered them, and they were afraid, and they entered the cloud, and a voice came from the cloud saying, This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him. When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone at that time what they had seen. Okay, Pastor, I thought that we were going on a road trip with Jesus. What does any of this have to do with Jesus going to Jerusalem? Well, verse 31 of the transfiguration that we see here in Luke chapter 9 is critically important to helping us understand what the road trip to Jerusalem means to Jesus. Remember what I said earlier about road trips? All kinds of hard stuff and cool stuff can happen on the way on a road trip, but it's what happens at the end that keeps us going. That's the reason why we go on a long road trip. And verse 31 is critically important to helping us understand what's at the end of the journey that Jesus is about to go on. This verse gives us a sliver of insight into the conversation that was being had between Moses and Elijah and Jesus. And it says there in verse 31, they spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring fulfillment at Jerusalem. So there we get some insight into the destination, all right? Something is going to happen in Jerusalem, all right? Something's going to happen in Jerusalem. Something's going to be brought to fulfillment in Jerusalem. But Jesus isn't in Jerusalem right now. Jesus is at the top of a mountain somewhere in Galilee, about 80 miles journey north of Jerusalem. But there's more here. Okay, so we know the where Jesus is going to be going. Here's the what and the why. Luke says that they spoke about his departure. Now, the Greek says they discussed his exodus. They discussed his exodus. Luke uses the Greek word exodus, and that is so important. It frames for us what Jesus is about to do. In his death, Jesus will reenact an event just like the great exodus from Egypt, only more so. In the first Exodus, Moses, who was just there talking to Jesus, Moses led the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt and brought them to the promised land. And in this new Exodus that Jesus is about to be a part of, Jesus will lead all of God's people out of the slavery of sin and death and home to their promised inheritance, a new creation in which the whole world will be redeemed. Wow. Now that's a destination. The exodus of God's people from Egypt is probably the foundational identifying story of God's people. But now a new exodus is coming. That's what's ahead of Jesus. That is the destination of his road trip. But his disciples still don't quite get it. And so before they leave the mountain, God the Father speaks to them from the cloud and says that they were frightened, and this voice comes out, and the voice of God says, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." Now, interestingly, those words echo almost exactly the words that Moses spoke in the book of Deuteronomy that Moses wrote, where he said, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him." So God's quoting Moses here. Like Moses might be like, did you hear? Like God quoted me. God gave you those words in the first place, Moses. That's not that cool. But this is amazing. Jesus has just been having this conversation with Moses 1,800 years ago, give or take a few hundred years. Moses prophesied the coming of Jesus, who's now talking with them face to face. And Moses said, "When he comes, listen to him." Then God the Father says, "When he comes, listen. Here he is, listen to him." He envelops the disciples, says, "Listen to him." Now guess what Jesus' very next words to the disciples in Luke are? "Listen carefully. Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you." So Moses told them to listen. God tells them to listen. God the Father. And now here's Jesus saying, "Listen carefully." Do we think this might be important to listen carefully? All right, so listen up. All right, this is what Jesus says in verse 44, "The Son of Man
is going to be delivered into the hands of men. The exodus of Jesus, the salvation of Jesus, will be nothing like they have imagined. He's going to be delivered into the hands of men? That doesn't sound like a salvation that they might expect. And so they still don't get it. In fact, Luke outright says they don't get it, verse 45, but they did not understand what this meant. So let me pause for a moment. So for Jesus' disciples, ignorance was bliss. When Jesus said these hard words, they kind of hear what they want to hear, don't they? Their minds are a bit set on their own agendas and their own ambitions. Look at the very next verse. It says, an argument started among the disciples as to which of them was the greatest. How does that happen? Jesus says, listen carefully. I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and I'm going to get turned over to men. I'm going to be handed over into the hands of men. And they start saying, yeah, well, which one of us is the greatest? Whew. They don't get it. They don't get it. We're catching a glimpse of just how badly, how deeply they are missing the plans and the purposes of Jesus. They're posturing for position while Jesus is about to embark on a road trip to his own death. Okay, so are we ready to start talking about the actual road trip itself? Now we know where we're going. Now we know what's going to happen. Jesus is going to die. And we know why a new exodus to save the entire cosmos. Bigger than the first exodus, now there's a new exodus coming. So, all right, let's go already. Here's the first verse. Are you ready? This is the verse that kicks off the travel narrative of Jesus. This kicks off the journey. We're going on a road trip. Here it is, Luke chapter 9, verse 51. It is subtle but powerful. It says, as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven. Now, the NIV adds, I hate it when they do this, they add those words to heaven. Those are not in the Greek text. Right? That's important for us to know, because this is what happens when translators do a little bit too much, and like maybe they get like, this is what that means, and so then they inject some meaning into it that actually wasn't there. But what it says is, as the time approached for Jesus to be taken up, this is another reference to that Exodus idea. And he's going to be taken up by way of the cross. Jesus is about to transition the world from enslaved to sin to emancipated from sin. Okay? That's all wrapped up in this idea of Exodus, this departure, Jesus being taken up. But here's the phrase I want for us to pay attention to. This is the launching point of our road trip. Jesus, it says, resolutely set out for Jerusalem. It's begun. He's going. Friends, I want for us to receive those words with all the love and all the grace, all the heroism that exists in those words. Jesus knows what waits for him in Jerusalem. Jesus knows the pain. He knows the humiliation. He knows the torture and the death that he will face. And yet it says he resolutely set out for Jerusalem. It literally says he set his face towards Jerusalem. I want us to remember that for one of the last verses that we're going to see this morning. He set his face towards Jerusalem. That means he determined himself to go. He went with resolve. Do you know that that's how much he loves you? Do you know that that's how much he desperately wants you to be with him forever? He knows that thing that you keep doing or keep thinking, and he still wants to be with you forever. He knows that annoying thing that you do, and he still wants to be with you forever. Jesus is running toward a cross built for you and for me. And he has resolved that he is going to be the one to take those nails and bleed his blood. This is his exodus, his salvation, and nothing will stop him. So Jesus resolutely sets out for Jerusalem. But not a moment, not a moment into this road trip, Jesus already starts to run into opposition. Verse 52 says, he sent messengers on ahead of him. Incidentally, that's the exact same language from Exodus chapter 23, verse 20, when God sent angels ahead of the people of Israel to prepare their way into the promised land. In fact, that word, the Greek word that's translated here as messengers, is the word angel. So he sends messengers on ahead of him. So Luke is continuing his Exodus motif here, and that's so important to Jesus' mission in Jerusalem. So he sends messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But, it says, the people there did not welcome him because he was heading to Jerusalem. Now, why Jesus and his disciples are stopped by these Samaritans is unclear, especially when we know from John's gospel, at least, that Jesus had been welcomed in Samaria earlier in his ministry. But I don't think that the reason is as important as what transpires next with James and John. Now remember, it was these two, James and John, and Peter, who were with Jesus up on the mountain, who witnessed the transfiguration. Peter already had a chance to embarrass himself, but with his own lack of understanding. Let's build some tents over here and some tents over here. And he didn't get it. Luke made that very clear. Now it's their turn. James and John, they're called the son. Jesus calls them the sons of thunder. It's their turn. And it says this. It says, when the disciples, James and John, saw this, that they had been rejected by the Samaritans and they wouldn't let them go through that way, they said, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them? What? This sounds like the most bizarre thing for them to say. But, let's cut them a little bit of slack. Remember, they did just witness Jesus talking to who? Moses and Elijah, and Elijah was the one prophet that they know from Scripture who actually did call down fire from heaven, all right? We just talked about this actually like 3 weeks ago, in a sermon 3 weeks ago. And then he went on to destroy the prophets of Baal. So now it's their turn. Now it's the Samaritans' turn, right? We're going to call down fire from heaven, and bam! It's another example of this over the head, missing what Jesus is all about. They see Jesus healing the sick. They see Jesus casting out demons. They see him giving sight to the blind, challenging authorities, having meetings with ancient celebrity prophets, all right? And instead of listening carefully to his words, they follow the lead of their own hearts, as we so often do, their own ambitions, their own cravings. They're a lot like us, are they not? But here's what I love about the disciples. The men and the women who followed Jesus, and there were a lot more than 12, by the way. We see that in the next chapter that we'll talk about probably next week. Jesus sends out 72. So there's at least 72 of them walking around with Jesus. These people who chose to follow Jesus, I love them because something did set them apart. But it wasn't because they knew their Bible so well. No. It wasn't because they were such good people. It wasn't because they were so well behaved. It certainly wasn't because they understood Jesus' teaching so well. No, clearly, from what we've already seen today, the cream of the crop of these disciples were struggling to figure out what Jesus was saying. No, what set the disciples apart from others was that they said yes. They said yes. juxtaposition of these confused disciples who say yes comes into full view in these last verses with three other people who don't say yes. The road trip has begun. They're on their way to Jerusalem. And the operative phrase now as they set out on this journey is, follow me. Follow me. I'm going. Follow me. So as they're walking around along the road, a man says to Jesus, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus says, that's incredible. We're going to Jerusalem to save the world. You should come along. No, that's actually not what he says. He says, foxes have dens, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lie his head. Why is Jesus so weird, right? Like, here we are. Even today, we're like, what? Excuse me? In other words, what Jesus is saying is, are you willing to give up the comforts of your life to say yes to me? We assume the unspoken answer here is no. Next, Jesus asks someone. He says, follow me. He just picture Jesus like going along the road. Dude, follow me. Follow me. And this person says, okay, Lord, but let me first go bury my father, to which Jesus says, let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and proclaim the kingdom of God. It's almost as if Jesus doesn't want followers, right? Now, honoring your father and wanting to bury your parents before leaving your family would have been among the highest values in this culture. In a moment, the way that Jesus says this, what he's communicating to them is, whatever you think is most important to you cannot be as important as following me. Are we ready to wrestle with that? Because that's what it means to say yes to Jesus. The last one is similar. A man says, I will follow you, Lord, but first let me go back and say goodbye to my family. Seems kind of like a reasonable request, right? But Jesus uses a very reasonable request, and Jesus is not saying it's not a reasonable request, but he uses a reasonable request to emphasize what it really means to say yes to him. So Jesus replies in this way, no one who puts a hand to the plow and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom of God. Now, we don't understand this because we don't plow. We're not farmers. But if you're trying to control a mule or a donkey or a bull that's pulling a plow for you, you cannot look backwards. Your eyes must stay forward. Otherwise, your line is going to go all over the place. You might hit a rock and destroy your expensive tool, your plow. But these words are beautiful, and they help us because they hearken back to what is really the central, beautiful verse and start of this whole sermon series in verse 51. It harkens back to verse 51 where Jesus, it says, he set his eyes to Jerusalem. He resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And so, as we close here today, Mike, you can come on up. The same questions come to us today. Are you willing to turn your eyes toward Jerusalem? With Jesus, to go where he goes, to care about the things that he cares about, to reject the things that he rejects. N.T. Wright says it this way. He says, if you're on a journey, the map that you need is the one that tells you where to go next, not the one for the road that you've already traveled. Where is Jesus asking you to travel? Not yesterday, but today and tomorrow. Are you ready to follow him wherever he goes, even if it's to a cross? Now, some of this And that's okay. By the way, some of this might be flying over our heads. Jesus does not ask us to have it all figured out. He asks us to listen. And perhaps, by his grace, to say yes. Yes. When he says, follow me. So for the next 5 weeks, we have a destination that is worth a road trip. And we have a traveling companion that is worth our allegiance. So as we go with Jesus toward Jerusalem and toward the cross, my hope is that we might find ways to reevaluate the things we say yes to and listen to a Savior God who hasn't stopped saying to each of us every day, follow me. Follow me. Jesus. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. There's so much here. There's so much here for us to miss. I pray that in the midst of trying to decipher ancient documents, that we might not miss you, that we might not miss your voice, the voice of the prophets, the voice of your Father, all of which are saying, listen, listen. God, cause our hearts to say yes and our feet to follow.